Hi, everybody. Welcome to Wrestling with the Law and Stuff. I'm Eric Anderson, and with me today for our first live broadcast, this is the sixth one we've prepared. This is one in which I decided, since I've done the others indoors, I was going to do this one outdoors. So we are over here at what we call the Dragon Manor, so-called because of our dog, Dragon. And I am joined by just an amazing individual, Alex Sharon. Pardon, let me get the straight. Alexander Hamilton Sharon, who is a noted writer. Many of you have seen him as a legal commentator on Fox Business. You've seen him on CNN and a variety of other places we'll get into as well. He's, as I said, awarded author for an article that he wrote with OC Weekly, and he wrote frequently for OC Weekly, and also a noted attorney. And with that, Alex, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm very honored to be here and honored to be the guest on the very first live/outdoor broadcast.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so unfortunately, I live on a corner, so maybe we might hear some noises as we go through this.
No worries.
But yeah, you know, we're probably people, we'll go through this. So Alex, let's talk a little bit about your background, because we know that you're a Long Beach boy.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about growing up in Long Beach.
That is such a loaded, in a good way, question. And Eric, I am absolutely honored to be on your show. I am a huge fan of yours. I respect you tremendously and have followed your career professionally, personally, over all the years since we've gone to school together. And this is such a pleasure to be here. And this is so in your wheelhouse, and happy to see you doing this. I am a Long Beach kid, and I wear that badge proudly, as I'm sure you do as well. Yep. Born and raised. And it's interesting. I think the Long Beach you and I were born and raised in is a little bit different than the Long Beach of today. I think the Long Beach you and I were raised in was a little more blue collar. I think it was a little more gritty. I think even though there were different areas of the city, there was a little bit of a commonality through it. I grew up in Belmont Shore and went to school, obviously, first at Signal Hill and then at Hughes Junior High and then at Pauley in the PACE program, which to this day, and you may attest to this as well, was probably the biggest influence in my life.
Yeah, tell people about Belmont Shore as opposed to other parts of Long Beach.
So Belmont Shore is a little bit closer, I think, culturally to Orange County than it probably is to the rest of Long Beach. It's the demographic there is very white. It's very upper middle class. It tends to align itself with its neighbors to the south, Seal Beach, Newport Beach. It's got a main strip, Second Street, which is obviously the commercial center of Belmont Shore, but it's a really safe, clean, sterile, white place to grow up. And I think it still is that today, although I don't think there was really ever any gentrification that went on in Belmont Shore. I think it stayed kind of the way that it was. But man, I could not afford to buy a house there today. But a nice place to grow up.
And then you talked about you had exposure to other parts of the city because you were in a magnet program in middle school, I know, over at Tap at Hughes. And then, as you mentioned, you were over at Pace. Now, Pace, one would think that it was pretty much enclosed all day with just kids from a particular area, but you had a chance to kind of branch out a bit and with other folks at the school. Tell us a little bit about that, and tell us how that kind of affected your ability from that point on to connect to other people.
So Pace was the, by definition, Pace was the gifted or accelerated academic program at Pauley High School. My home school would have been Wilson High School, which is where most of the kids from Belmont Shore and Belmont Heights went to high school. But Pauley, as you know, located in the inner city, in the central city of Long Beach, and was incredibly diverse. And it was diverse from a lot of different perspectives. It was academically diverse. It was culturally diverse. It was socioeconomically diverse, it was intellectually diverse, it was athletically diverse, and it was probably the single biggest influence, like I said, on my life professionally. For those of us who grew up in the suburbs, which Belmont Shore really was, Going to a place like Pauley was magical. You got to meet and interact with kids and faculty from all different parts of the city. And Eric, I know you know this, Long Beach, by census data, is the most diverse city in the country, or at least at one time was, and that really manifests itself at Pauley. So I feel bad in a way for kids who went to traditional high school programs where they grew up. They didn't get the same, I think, enrichment and the same experience that you and I did. It was really, and by the way, Eric, this was at a time, too, when diversity across all those spectrums was not so cool. I think it was much cooler for kids to kind of stay in the neighborhood where they grew up. So for, you know, kids like you and I to go to a PACE program at Pauley, I think was a little cutting edge. I don't know if you agree with that or...
Oh, absolutely. It was very much different then. It hadn't become an issue. And in fact, when you had the chance to listen to the interview that we did with Mr. Gerritsen, and many of you wouldn't know this yet, but Mr. Gerritsen was our history teacher, APS history teacher, our sophomore year. That was a big draw. And his experiences, I mean, when you hear it, you'll understand why he fit in so well at Pauley. So that's kind of a little tease for what's coming up. But PACE was also a very competitive program. In that there was a lot of pressure for people to go to the Ivy League schools, UC schools, Stanford. As I said, if you're a little mentally deficient like me, you went to Claremont College. But you at the time did something that was very different in the late 80s. You went to the University of Michigan, and this was at a time where the University of Michigan and Ohio State and Wisconsin and Minnesota had not gained large national reputations. And they certainly weren't being thought about on the West Coast. So what was it? What was the Michigan story that drew you to become a Wolverine?
That's such a great question. And it's interesting because I get the question I used to get the most when I would tell people that I went to Michigan for undergraduate was, well, why'd you go there coming from Southern California? And I get that less and less and less as the years go on. So I think you're absolutely right in that. And, you know, Eric, the program you and I went to was incredibly competitive. I would probably venture to say it was probably the most competitive program, certainly in the region, if not the country. We felt that. We felt that on a daily basis. There was always pressure to do well on standardized test score or on standardized tests. There was always pressure to get into a good college. They always touted the fact that most of these kids got into UCs. I mean, schools that are impossible to get in today. And maybe I think I wanted to get away from that a little bit. I wanted to go to a big public school. Public school was very important to me at the time, and that was sort of the Pauley influence. Public school was very important, and I wanted to go to a big athletic school that had tradition. And that also was an influence from Pauley as well. And you know that as a former football player there in that program. And so I think it really drew, that was really what drew me to that. It was a big public school, great athletic tradition, and it wasn't in California.
And yet when you were done, you came immediately right back to California.
I did. That's what four winters in Ann Arbor will do to you. So I remember showing up there. I kid you not, and you and I think we know what cold was going up into the San Bernardino Mountains. I showed up my freshman year in Ann Arbor with a hooded sweatshirt and figured that would get me through the winter. And then, ironically, realized that I needed something a little more stronger for the winter. And I actually had our friend Brian Fisk, send us his old Long Beach Pauley swim jacket, because it was the only jacket I knew of that was warmer than a hood and sweatshirt. Wanted to get back home after 4 years of that winter.
Now, from there, you went to Loyola for law school. Two questions. One is, what is it that drew you to the law? Did you come from a family with a long history of lawyers? Or what was it that made you think, this is what I want to do?
Well, I think there was certainly a lot of that. And it's interesting. I had this conversation with somebody a couple of weeks ago. I remember from being at a very young age, just being adamant that I was going to be a lawyer. And I couldn't tell you why. And I don't know if it's because I was enamored with how lawyers were portrayed in movies, which was very influential to me. I think you and I were schooled in a system that put a lot of emphasis on oratory skills and being able to argue. I think I grew up in a family, being a second generation immigrant family, that was Jewish, where academics were very important and debating was very important. And, you know, it was really like a scene out of Curb Your Enthusiasm. You had to argue your way out of everything. And I think that tradition led me to, you know, kind of pursue something in the law. And I really thought at the time, Eric, that I wanted to use the law to get into something else. So I never was enamored with wanting to practice law for a long time, although I did. I always saw law as sort of a vehicle to do something else, but almost something that had been predetermined at a very young age.
Now, that brings up two questions for me. One is, because you mentioned the strong Judaic tradition. Now, unlike some of us who came to Judaism late and got in, you were born into it. You were raised into it.
So well, as long as you get it right eventually, that's fine.
I've got some Pentecostal relatives right now with us. Going, oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus, yeah. Lord. Oh, protect the Lord. He'll find that one. I guess it's the Black Irish side. But what was it that you found or that you think in the Judaic tradition that kind of led to so many lawyers, or at least in your case, that led you to being a lawyer?
I'll be very honest and very un-PC with you.
Mm-hmm.
When you grow up as a Jewish kid in Southern California in the 1970s and the 1980s, you don't have a lot of athletic role models to look at or to follow. You don't have a lot of real cool kind of hipsters to follow. You know, your peer group and your parents' peer group are doctors and they're lawyers and they work their asses off, and that's what you see and that's kind of what you know. So I think that, you know, that's not a theological Jewish tradition, but I think that's a cultural Jewish tradition, and I'm very proud of that. And I think, by the way, that's not just that the Jewish population in the U.S. doesn't have a monopoly on that. I think there are other cultural groups and other socioeconomic groups and that really drive that home to their kids. And, you know, I think you and I saw that growing up. There were kids who, after school, went and hung out at the beach, and then there were kids who went and studied. And, you know, I think that was influenced a lot by kind of their families and kind of the traditions they grew up in.
Yeah, or they were doing violins, they were learning computers, building. I mean, it's just a ridiculous amount of things that they were able to come up with and do. And then for those who were on the more athletic side, as I found as well, they, of course, then parlayed that later into other things with that same kind of drive of just like they would get up and do the extra laps or do the extra reps.
Right.
They now, of course, get up and no, I've got to see what the new sheet is because I got to interview this guy. I got to know what's going on.
Yep.
That kind of hard work drive keeps going. Yep. So you said that you knew it was going to be an avenue to, I'm going to apologize for this truck going by, you knew it was going to be an avenue to something else. Did you know what that something else was going to be?
Well, I was always enamored, as I think you were, with politics. I think you and I saw in growing up in Long Beach at that time, politics was something and government was something that was really sacred. And I really believed, and I still do to an extent, but I did then, fully unfettered, believe that government was where the best and the brightest, that's what they were drawn to, that the government attracted the best and the brightest. And I think, you know, we were certainly, well, I don't mean to speak, I certainly did not consider myself, disenfranchised. I didn't consider myself unable to get into government. But I looked at those guys like rock stars. I mean, we did youth and government programs when we were younger. You know, you and I were very fortunate to have really good teachers at Poly, both in U.S. history and European history, and you know, even our government classes that really drove that home. Government was for the best and the brightest, and I really wanted to try that. I really thought that that's where law would lead me.
And so, okay. And so, Alex, when you started practicing, where were you focused first, and how did you make the transition from there to the more political end? Because you eventually become, I think it's fair to say, a pretty big player in the local government, not necessarily political, but in the actual getting things done aspect. And so I want to go into how you made that transition and how that also, that transition was affected, how it affected the way you practice law.
Scott, that you asked really good. You should do this for a living. You know, if the law thing doesn't work out, this is a good avenue for you. You know, I
can only be paid to talk and think. That's the only two things I can do.
No, you and I both. You know, I think I was a little, I had some rose-colored glasses on when I first started practicing law, and I worked for a big firm in downtown L.A. and had, as I'm sure a lot of our colleagues did at the time, a pretty substantial amount of law school debt, and needed a practical way to pay that off. So I worked in a firm that had, you know, about 150 lawyers, and your worth was based on how many hours you billed a month. And it didn't matter, in my opinion, the quality of work you did, as long as your timesheets were turned in every day and you had, you know, 10 to 12 hours billed. And, you know, I did that for a few years and the money was okay. But it was a lot of work and I wasn't doing anything that I considered particularly rewarding personally, you know, now, and again, I'm going to be very
let me interject because this brings up something that I find curious, because one of the things that we talk about here on this podcast is, as we talk about, is the storytelling, the ability to storytell. Is it fair to say that you were frustrated with the lack of opportunity to actually tell good stories?
That is such a good question, and the answer is a resounding yes. So, you know, I was doing primarily work for property owners, and as I very sarcastically tell people, you know, I think that those first years of law doing civil litigation and being primarily on the defense side is figuring out ways to take big pots of money from this group of white people and giving it to this other group of white people. And I know that sounds very cynical, but I dare anyone to challenge me on that. And I couldn't tell good stories. That's a great way to put that, Eric. So when I was, you know, whether it was a court trial or a jury trial, and by the way, these firms, one of the advantages, I think, is that they let young lawyers try cases, which I would encourage any young lawyer who's interested in doing litigation, go find a firm or go work for a public agency, the DA's office or the public defender's office, that will let you try cases when you're young. Because
people may not understand that most lawyers really don't know what to do in a courtroom. They're not trained to do it. They're not taught enough to do it. And that just because the whole practice of law changed over the last 100 years. And so the opportunity to be at a place, tell people, how rare is it to find a large firm that will let young lawyers try cases?
So true. And I know you well enough, Eric, that I know that was part of what attracted you to the law, was the ability to tell stories and get in front of a judge and get in front of a jury. And I was shocked at how few of my colleagues who went to work for big white shoe firms in New York and LA ever set foot in a courtroom, let alone try a case. And so I would venture to guess, you know, maybe 90% of those large firms don't let anybody who doesn't have 5-6 years experience open their mouth in a courtroom. And I was lucky enough to find a firm, you know, in LA that let me do that at a very young age. And I think that's what kept me in it, probably longer than I would have on my own volition had I not had the chance to do that. And so that was really the silver lining. I mean, you and I do discovery practice, which is, you know, answering discovery questions, interrogatories, requests for production of documents. And it's, in my opinion, and I have the luxury of saying this now because I don't do it for a living, really monotonous.
I'll go further. It is not intended to get to the truth or to get to answers. It's intended to rack up billable hours. That's why it exists.
Agreed. And I'll re-raise you on that and tell you that I think that, and again, your experience may be different than mine, but my experience is that if I go back and I look at all of those cases that I handled as a young litigator, I would bet in about 99% of those cases, I could have told you, and opposing counsel could have told you the outcome on day one. But you have to do the kabuki and go through the motions and spend a lot of money and spin your wheels to get to that outcome that everybody knows is inevitable. And so that's what I liked about getting in court, is because it was unpredictable, maybe. And you really did have to rely on your storytelling ability. And I remember as a young lawyer, I was very fortunate to have a case with Tom Girardi, who's one of the best well-known plaintiff's attorneys in Los Angeles. And I was, a fourth or fifth year attorney, and he had been practicing law for 30, 40 years, and you know, had racked up hundreds of millions of dollars of verdicts. And it was a wrongful death case that involved a child. And I lost that case on his opening statement when he opened his mouth. And his very first words to the jury were, "Sometimes the smallest caskets are the heaviest to carry." And I knew at that point that I had lost the case, but we had to go through a 2-week trial. And anyway, storytelling is very important. I think that's what kept me in it longer than I probably would have on my own.
Now, when you're developing this, trying to figure out how to come up with an opening, because some people think that we just, you know, we're just gifted and we could just, you know, toss this stuff out. But there's a trap that could be set in opening if you overpromise and you underdeliver, and trying to find the method of underpromising and overdelivering. And about how many trials did it take before you picked up on that?
That is such a good question. I was very lucky to have a mentor at this firm, a gentleman by the name of Dana McCune, who coincidentally was a Long Beach Poly graduate, maybe 20 years before us. He told me, or he instilled in me, the importance of keeping it short, keeping it focused, keeping it simple for the jury, and not overpromising to your point and underdelivering. He taught me that at a very young, you know, sort of lawyerly age. And I remember having a discovery dispute with opposing counsel when I was a first year lawyer, and I'd asked for a simple extension of a week to answer some discovery, and the opposing counsel had said no. And I had written this 3-page letter to opposing counsel saying, you know, how dare you, this violates, you know, the rules of professional conduct and blah, blah, blah. I gave it to my mentor, Dana, to edit, and he redlined all 3 pages. And he wrote as the edit, "Thank you. This will acknowledge that you did not grant my request for an extension. Please know that you'll be afforded every courtesy and request for extension that you ask going forward. Look forward to talking to you soon." And that was probably the greatest lesson I learned as a lawyer. But
sometimes the stories we have to learn how to tell are to each other.
Correct. Yeah, completely agree.
And I think one of the things that can be a difference for someone like yourself is, because let's face it, a lot of people in our business are very privileged. They come from privileged backgrounds. They've been around privileged backgrounds in one way or another. What people call regular people, and I think we can all say that there's no such thing as regular people. Everybody's just got their own set of quirkiness. They may not necessarily grasp how to approach them. Whereas you'd had that experience of being around a diverse group of people for numerous years. And were you consciously pulling upon that, or did that just become kind of automatic as you were going through your career?
So I did not realize, and I don't know if you had the same experience, because I know you went back east to law school, and you must have, you know, that must have been accentuated back east, although you went to a Catholic law school, so I don't know. I did pull upon that, but I also did not realize.
Yeah, I went to the Catholic law school.
That's right, sorry.
Let's get.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cloud the issue. But I did not realize until I went to law school, and probably even when I started practicing law, the privilege that was out there and the backgrounds that people came from. Even though I was blessed and grew up in a good part of Long Beach, you and I were still from Long Beach, right? We weren't from West LA. We weren't from Pacific Palisades. We weren't from Mal, and I did not realize the extent of privilege that was out there. So I drew upon that, and I continue to draw upon that for sure.
Yeah, I still say, no matter where I was born, no matter where I've lived, in my heart of hearts, I'm still a simple kid from Long Beach.
Agreed, completely agree, completely agree. And there's something.
So how did you find your?
Special.
How did you find your next act that got you into what was the stepping stone that you wanted to try something different?
So I think as a 10th or 11th year attorney, I had tried a bunch of cases and I had hopped around between firms. I ended up having a case that was a civil litigation matter, but it had a little bit of a maritime undertone to it. And the party was represented by a Long Beach lawyer named Eric Wise, who we grew up with the Wise family in Belmont Shore, and they live, you know, a few blocks away, and I'd always known them. And Susan Wise, who was also a lawyer, University of Chicago, educated, had been obviously friends with my parents, and her daughter and my sister were friends and had gone to Pauley Pace, where you and I went to school. And he offered me a job and said, I will teach you maritime law. It's a really unusual sort of niche area of practice, but it's a good living and it's a good area of the law, and I'll be your mentor. And I took him up on it. So moved back to Long Beach, had been practicing in LA prior to that, and learned this wonderful world of maritime law. And with that came learning about trade, and then also learning about, unbeknownst to me, politics, because a lot of maritime law centered around the ports of LA and Long Beach, which are really the epicenter of the international trade community in the United States, and sort of learned the politics that came along with that. So I had this wonderful education for about 5 or 6 years working for Eric Wise, where I learned international trade and maritime law, but also the politics and the government aspect that went along with that.
Yeah. Alex, let's talk about, how do you go from learning how to talk to a jury and a judge to now you have to talk to politicians or governmental entities, in which you walk into a room and everybody's got a totally different agenda?
So it's you know, you and I learned at Pauley, you know, in either our English classes or AP English classes or our journalism classes, that you need to speak to your audience. And it was just a matter of recalibrating your story to speak to a particular audience. And politicians, for the most part, and elected officials and government staffers speak a different language, but it's a language that can be learned. And you just need to be exposed to it and practice it enough. But it does take some, you do need to tweak it. It's very different when you go and you advocate for a client and be in front of a judge than going in front of an elected official and advocating, because their constituencies are very different. The judge really has no constituency other than, you know, the law.
Yeah. Without naming names, you said there was a different language involved. Tell us about examples of discovering this different language that politicians use. Because as lawyers, we learn that too. We there's a different language we get accustomed to. Then you shift into something else. You know, the construction guys say something different.
Yes.
Then you start working with cops. They speak a different language. Tell us about some of the changes you noticed and how you were able to adapt to that.
So for the most part, elected officials and politicians involved in this area, in trade and transportation and the port business, although I don't think it's too different from other concentrations or areas, you know, are very cautious, right? Judges tend not to be too cautious. I think judges feel like they're empowered, which I think they should be, to, you know, say, this is my interpretation of the law, and if I'm wrong, an appellate court will overturn me. I think elected officials and politicians don't have that, and I think they're a little more cautious, because ultimately what they're worried about is re-election or, you know, staying in a decision-making capacity. And so I think the language tends to be a little more cautious is the best way I can describe that.
Do you ever find that that's frustrating, that you're trying to, because they're so cautious, that you have to try and dig to get what they're really getting at, as opposed to them coming right out and saying it?
All the time. And, you know, you and I are taught, and we're taught in law school to, you know, argue facts and law and reason. And, you know, that kind of goes out the window a little bit in the political arena. And, you know, they play a little bit of a part. They're a small component, but I think ultimately it's pragmatism. It is, you know, doing what's right, not only for the constituency, but to make sure that the elected official can, you know, sort of stay in power, which is fine. That's our democratic system, and that's the way we set it up, and I'm a big fan of that. But I think ultimately I had to sort of unlearn some of the stuff that you and I learned in law school about facts and reason, give way to pragmatism and sort of expediency.
So when you're having to deal with that, this idea of this pragmatism, how much effort are you taking to find out what their political goals are as well, in addition to what's the goal you're trying? Because I know you've been involved in giant projects involving all kinds of growth in Long Beach, for example. I mean, you were really tied into a lot of that going on. And you're going to get a variety of competing interests. You're going to have those people who don't want anything to change. You have those people who want some things to change, but not that thing to change. You know, how are you able to go about and kind of get your hooks into what it is that everybody wants and how you have to take that into consideration when you're dealing with your client?
It's such a great question, Eric. So I still, to this day, and I know this is probably an exercise that a lot of, you know, third or fourth graders do, but I still, when I get a new client or I get a new project, I draw on a piece of paper a bunch of circles, and I put in those circles, you know, let's say a property owner wants to get a development entitled, and they have to do it before, you know, the city of Los Angeles. I draw a circle for the city and what are their interests. I draw a circle for the developer, what are their interests. Draw a circle for the elected official, what are their interests. And I try to find those concentric circles. And so when people ask me whether I'm a Democrat or Republican, or I tell them I'm really a concentrist. I try to find where those concentric circles intersect. And I've always tried to focus my practice on that. So the elected officials have a goal. They want to, you know, have wins and successes so that they can get reelected. Staff has a goal because they want to, you know, make sure that they keep their jobs and you know, do a good job in front of, you know, the agency or before the agency that they work. You know, the citizens, the residents of a city want, you know, they have interests. They want to make sure their quality of life, you know, stays the same or is enhanced. And so I literally draw these concentric circles. And sometimes it's tough in this political climate.
All right. Now let's talk a little bit about the other storytelling you've come to do, and that's your writing. Now, what is it that got you into writing for articles for daily magazines, you know, OC Weekly? Tell us about that.
So I'm very lucky that I grew up the son of two college professors who both had a passion and an interest for reading and writing and instilled that in their children, and always loved writing and wrote creatively sort of off and on as a kid, but you know, never really took it seriously. And I think that was, you know, one regret, you know, looking back, is that maybe I didn't take that more seriously when I was younger, because again, maybe coming from that tradition where you have to be a doctor or a lawyer, yeah, go to an Ivy League school, that you know, you can't be a creative writer. There's no money in that, so why pursue it? But I had always, you know, had this need for a creative outlet. And, you know, when I was going through a separation, you know, really relied on that as sort of a tool to kind of get me through those times. And I was very fortunate that I had a peer and a mentor named Nick Hsiao, who's a brilliant writer, and happened to be the editor of the OC Weekly at the time. Nick Hsiao, his kids went to the same school as my kids in Long Beach and got to know him. But he was the author of a book called Kill the Messenger, which was made into a film with Jeremy Renner, which is a true story, or based on a true story, of a San Jose Mercury News reporter, Gary Webb, who broke the story about the nexus between the CIA and the crack cocaine epidemic in South Central Los Angeles in the 1980s. Just a brilliant book and a brilliant movie. I would encourage everyone watching to watch that. But out of the blue, just emailed him and said, look, I'm really feeling the need for a creative outlet. I want to write a story. I've always had an affinity for pop culture pop culture in Southern California in particular. Will you give me the chance? And he said, yes. I wrote this 20-page piece on an old radio contest that happened back in 1981 that really influenced me as a kid. And he sent it back to me. He said, dude, you're a good writer, but you got to cut this down. This is way too long. So took his advice, trimmed what was about 10,000 words down to about 1,200 words, and he published it and then asked me to write some more and did that.
Let's talk about that editing process, because now you're doing a different kind of storytelling. You know, now you're doing it in a way in which you're going to convey something. You're going to convey not just the facts, but I take it as well, you want to try and convey the emotion of, you know, what it was that you found interesting about that event in 81. How do you decide what it is you're cutting out after you've devoted so much into it?
It's so funny. I remember writing this first draft of this article called The Mighty 690, and it was about a radio contest that a station that you and I listened to growing up, The Mighty 690, put on in the summer of 1981, where they buried $50,000 in cash somewhere in Southern California, and they gave clues, and you had to figure it out and kind of figure out where it was. And I wrote this essay. It really wasn't an article, it was an essay. And he came back to me and said, look, he goes, if you're a good writer, it'll come through. He goes, it doesn't matter if it's 10 words or 100 words, if you're a good writer, it'll come through. Forget about the essay, just tell me what happened. And for storytellers like you and I, who have the good fortune of talking for a living, that comes through in writing. And you know, I think lawyers tend to make really, really, really good writers because they're forced to, right? You and I have to write motions, and there's a page limit on that,
yeah,
right?
And I hate that part.
Exactly. No, you and I could probably keep writing.
Yeah, I want to get up and argue. That's the writing is the tough part.
But there's a pay, and also, and you know this from your courtroom practice, if you go on too long, a judge will cut you off. Yeah. So you got to get your argument across, because you may not get the chance to keep arguing.
They've never cut me off.
Well, they cut me off plenty.
Yeah, well, at least not in the last 17 years. I think the first three, I was cut off a lot. There was a lot of. Yeah. I was waiting for the orchestra to come on at some point.
The hook. Right.
Took me a while to figure out what a judge meant when they said submitted.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. For those of you who don't know, the term submitted is essentially a lawyer saying, I'm done, I'm submitting now for your consideration, Your Honor. When a judge asks you submitted, what they're saying is, are you going to shut up now so I can go ahead and make a decision?
Yeah.
And that's been the clue that now you can stop. So from there, let's also talk about now the Wally George article. Let's talk about that.
So, you and I growing up, everybody who grows up says, well, where I grew up and when I grew up was incredibly special. But you and I know that growing up in Long Beach in Southern California in that era was really special. We know that. And we were exposed to a lot of just fascinating cultural phenomena, one of which was this wonderful world of cable access. And in Southern California, we had, a whole myriad of kooks and, wonderful talent and not so wonderful talent, but it was all really good. And one of those was obviously Wally George, who was an old political hack from the 50s, 60s, and 70s in L.A., who used to work with Sam Yorty, the old mayor of Los Angeles.
Rebecca De Mornay's dad.
Rebecca De Mornay's dad, better known as. And really fit the mold of that early 80s Reagan Republican conservative in Orange County. So he broadcast a show from the KDOC station in Orange County, played to a largely white male audience from the suburbs of Orange County who loved the flag and loved Ronald Reagan and loved John Wayne and very much soaked that in. And I always loved
the America fuck yeah crowd.
The America, no A, the America fuck yeah crowd, right? And I always loved watching that show, because he was, and for those people who don't remember Wally George, he really was the precursor to a lot of the Jerry Springer shows and the spinoff, where he would literally kick guests off if they disagreed with him to play to his crowd. But the article that I wrote about Wally George was a little more pointed, and it really pointed out the fact that there's been such a change in conservatism, at least in my view, from the 1980s in Southern California to what it is now with Donald Trump and sort of what the Republican Party looks like today. And my point was that Wally George used to have white supremacists on his show, and he would absolutely lay into them and tell them that they were the scum of the earth and kick them off the show. And the article really raises the point, I wonder if that would happen today, in today's, you know, sort of conservative party. I wonder if that would happen today. I wonder if there's a place for people like Wally George, who, as good Republicans and good conservatives, understood that racism and bigotry and anti-Semitism were wrong and weren't afraid to say that.
You know, I think part of what makes that interesting is Wally obviously was a great performer. In wrestling, we would say that he was good on the stick. You know, he knew what to say to get the draw going. And one of the things that's very important amongst them is to make sure that nobody thinks you're racist. So you're able to take an extreme example like that, and he can rip that. He can rip the neo-Nazis. He can rip the Klan people. What he wouldn't do, though, is if you were to brought up the comments that Reagan made in the 60s, he wouldn't rip into that.
I think there's some truth to that. I think that's very valid. I think that's very valid. What really inspired me to write that article on Wally George, was what happened in Charlottesville, and to see the president of the United States talk about the fact that they're very fine people on both sides, as if there's some sort of moral equivalency between, you know, people who burn crosses and say Jews will not replace us to people who don't say that. And that's really the line that I was trying to draw. And it's interesting. I went back and watched those old Wally George episodes, and you can pull them up on YouTube. And sometimes KDOC, which is still around today, actually plays those. But make no mistake, Wally George was still incredibly homophobic. There were still lots of episodes where, you know, he would rally against gay marriage, etc. So it's not a blanket pass on his thoughts. It's just for that particular issue, I think it was an interesting contrast.
Oh, I thought it was a fascinating article. I really did. Great. Someone's going to make a joke about me coughing while smoking. My niece is going to watch this and they go, "Uncle, you need to stop." But it's funny because here's the thing. Those people, they exist in juries. They exist in boardrooms. They exist in, obviously, in the powers of government. So the issue is that when you're dealing with an issue where you might come across those difficult points for them, how do you relate to them?
That's such a great question. And you know this better than I do, because I think you've inevitably tried more cases than I have. But the reading the jury, something different resonates with each of those jurors, and you don't know, you got to guess. But again, I go back to that sort of concentric circle approach. But it is it's really difficult, and I really do believe, and again, you know this better than I do, I think that you win or lose cases more often than not based on jury selection and being able to tell the right story and hit just the right notes with just enough jurors.
And voir dire is a difficult place to tell a story, because you're not allowed to tell much of a story, but you've got to ask questions that are designed to draw somebody else out to tell their story. And for those who understand, voir dire is where you are questioning the jury. Now, in some places, they don't have it.
Right.
You know, some do a very limited form. Here in California, it's pretty extensive. You get to ask a great deal of questions. Some countries don't have it at all. It's, whoever the first 12 in the box, that's who you get. That's just the way life goes. So we often call it jury deselection. And so let's talk a little bit about your approach to voir dire. What do you do to draw out more information from somebody without running the risk that you're going to alienate somebody else who's sitting in the panel?
That is so hard. And, you know, I think that as storytellers, we learn to put meaning into questions as much as we do into answers. And so by asking a particular question in a particular way, I think you've all, in some ways, almost answered or force the person to answer in a certain way. And, you know, the other thing, and I haven't done Voynich in quite some time, but I certainly study it and still am fascinated by it. But I think it's okay, you know, during my days, during Voynich, to be provocative. I think it's okay to be provocative. I think people don't respond well to tap dances and to, you know, avoiding the obvious. I think it's okay to be a little bit provocative.
To be a little direct.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
I recall being in Shasta County where I was a prosecutor. And for those who don't know, Shasta County is in far northern California. So far that I thought it might actually be Oregon for a while. And because I never heard of the place. And I recall I was working at the DA's office, so I'm a prosecutor, I'm doing a voir dire, and this lady says, well, you know, police can never be trusted, and right now may not be the best time to tell a pro-police story after recent events, but, you know, she said, the police can't be trusted, so there's no way they can ever be kind or fair to people of color, particularly black people. Now, remember, I'm the prosecutor, and I'm looking at her, she says this, I said, so it's your opinion, then, that the police and black people could never work together. She said, no, could never happen. Now, I know this juror is lost. You know, she's out. But as I ask the question, I start looking at the other jurors so that they can understand, you know, kind of what's happening here. So that I maybe turn around and say as well, is there anybody else who thinks that you can't be fair already to the police? And that's kind of how you draw that, because they heard that statement, which was just, I'm hard on police, but that's a ridiculous statement, right, when you have a black prosecutor standing right in front of you.
No doubt.
And Shasta also, for those who don't know, is one of the least diverse places you'll ever be in your entire life. I literally changed the census numbers when I moved there. Yeah, I think it went from 0.06, I think, to 0.08. I think that was what the number was. Yeah,
So you moved the needle.
That's right, I moved the needle. Actually, I got to tell a story. This was during Voynich, the judge, great judge, you know, he looked like a straight out of the 19th century with the right, you know, the beard and everything, and he had a very deliberate way of speaking like this. He never raised his voice, but if he wanted to, he could make you feel about 3 inches small. And this is my first trial in Shasta, and he says at one point, because it was a case in which we had a black male defendant, the alleged victim in the case was, I convicted him, so I can say the victim in the case was a white female. And the judge goes in and says that to the jury to see if there's any racial bias. And he says, you know, the victim in this case is a Caucasian female, and the defendant is an African-American male. So we want to know if there's any biases. And then he stops and he goes, and also the prosecutor in this case is an African-American male. To which I had to go, I am?
No, that is, you know, the one constant, Eric, the one constant of law practice that I learned is that people's biases and prejudices and, you know, backgrounds and context all come to the forefront. You know, we try as hard as we can as a legal system to suppress that a little bit. And, you know, judges during voir dire, when they do their questioning of the jurors, say, you know, this is no place to, you know, showcase your biases and your prejudices. But you and I know from the way the law goes and is practiced that all comes. It's not just in the background. It's in the forefront.
Oh, yeah, yes. And it's very important, I think, as well, to try and draw that out. Because, again, at least in voir dire, we're able to tell people, look, we're not saying you're evil. This may not be the right case for you.
Correct.
There may be other cases that are better for you. That's all. Correct. And I think that with that, you don't alienate them. Because no one likes to be people hear racism, they might think, well, it means I'm a bad person. Well, it kind of does, yes, but you know, they don't want to be told they're a bad person, and so they kind of have a reflection of that they don't want to deal with. So you have to find that other way. What was interesting with that judge, who'd been on the bench at that point probably 30 years,
right.
When I spoke to him after the trial, we were in his chambers, and I told him as well, you know, I'm the prosecutor. The jury doesn't need to worry about the bias against me. That's not what we're dealing with here. It was very cordial, no problem. He was great, one of the best judges I've ever seen in my life, just great judge. And he said, well, Mr. Anderson, I must confess, this is the first time I've been in this situation.
Right. It's an interesting, it's an interesting practice.
Yeah, which didn't happen to me in Boston, I'll tell you.
Right. Right.
So now, as we get ready to come to our last debate, let's have a little bit of fun with this here. I know that during this time of year, you've probably usually have already made a trip to Dodger Stadium. How are you doing, you know, with no baseball right now?
It is really, really rough. It's really, really rough. And I need baseball. I need Michigan football. I need golf. I need anything on TV to watch. I'm such an avid sports fan, as I know you are. And
yeah, I was watching the NASCAR racing a couple of weeks ago.
Oh my god, how was that?
Well, the great thing was it was a lot shorter.
Okay.
See, I can't watch NASCAR because like I cannot watch, you know, 4 hours of these guys, you know, rednecks turning left. I just can't keep doing that. But you know, for the E thing, the race was much shorter, and admittedly, I think it gave me a better appreciation. Obvious, at least for what the drivers do, because the translation of them, a group of NBA players suddenly playing, you know, NBA 2K, that's not a great transfer.
But they take these
drivers, they put them in these simulators that are almost just like the cars they drive, and that instinct kind of kicks in, and to hear them talk, I mean, except, of course, for the guy who got in trouble for, you know, saying nigger. during a NASCAR broadcast. Though, of course, I'm sitting thinking, did they really think this was the first time a NASCAR driver said the word? Yeah.
That's not virgin territory right there.
Yeah, I mean, I love how, dude, everybody can hear you.
But I will one-up you on that. And my son and I watched at about 1 in the morning on ESPN2, the National, and this was an actual event. This wasn't a rebroadcast of something that happened 10 years ago. This had happened just last week. Was the National Cornhole Championships. So you got that.
Yeah. First of all, I don't know why anybody wants to gather. I was at a retreat with my cigar club from Shasta. First time I'd seen this game, someone says, hey, Eric, you want to play cornhole? And I'm like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
You want me to play your what?
Yeah, they need to rename it first. Yeah,
they need to rename that badly. Just
agreed.
Now, also as well, you know, growing up, as I recall, you were a little bit of a wrestling fan too.
Huge wrestling fan. My brother and I would watch what was then WWF.
Mm-hmm.
We would sneak out of our Hebrew school class at Temple Israel there on 3rd and Loma in Long Beach and go down to the room that had the TV in it and watch Saturday and Sunday morning wrestling, and was a huge fan of old school WWF, Bob Backlund, the Iron Sheik, Hulk Hogan, those guys, and remember WrestleMania 1, and getting that on our TV in our den and just being in heaven.
What was it that drew you to wrestling?
You know, I think it was the theater of it. It was really the theater of it, and these don't get me wrong, and I know I'm talking to the right audience. I mean, these guys are athletes, and you know, it is a physical sport as any other, in fact probably more so, with the risk of injury, but it is such good theater, and it really is, it really captures, you know, political and social and economic issues that are going on, and it's just a great venue for all that stuff to come out. I mean, I remember during the height of the Cold War, you know, that playing out every Sunday on WWF with
Nikolai Volkov
and the Iron Sheik, and you know, and Sergeant Slaughter and those guys, and it's so Americana, and it's so kitsch, and it's just a great microcosm of what's going on in the country politically. And I absolutely, my brother and I, to this day, just still love talking about, you know, Junkyard Dog and you know, Jimmy Superfly Snuka and that whole era.
Outstanding. Now, also, let's talk a little bit before we leave. What got your interest in the cigars?
You know, I never smoked in high school and didn't smoke in college. And I lived with a guy in law school who subscribed to Cigar Aficionado magazine and smoked cigars. And I tried it, and I really enjoy it. I know nothing about brands or manufacturers. My favorite brand is whatever somebody hands me. And I rely on guys like you, Eric, to educate me and tell me what's good. But, you know, our firm, actually, we've represented over the years a lot of cigar lounges in Southern California. Yeah. and really enjoy it as a sort of as a process.
I'd say that for me, one of the things that I love about it is it invites conversation. It invites a chance to slow down in this speedy world. The great thing I like is you have a group of people together who could come from all kinds of different backgrounds, and they will have a wonderful, polite, yet enthusiastic conversation about anything. And everybody shake hands afterwards and enjoys the stick in the drawer.
Could not have said it better myself.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to having you out here over at Dragon Manor. You know, help us get go through some of these cigars. As I said, I got a little nervous when my supply here got down to under 230. Fortunately, a client just refreshed me because I was worried I wasn't going to get through the pandemic. But
do you mean 230?
That's right, 230. Well, you know, I have a locker. Obviously, I have two humidors here at the house. There's one at the office. I have a locker in L.A. I have a locker in Boston. I have a locker in the Bay Area. I have a locker in Shasta County.
I love it.
I don't have a locker in Seattle or Portland yet. But then again, thanks to this, I may not be traveling there like I used to.
There you go.
What's the big change you think is going to happen in our profession as a result of this pandemic?
You know, I think that, here's what I think is going to change, and here's what I hope is going to change. What I think is going to change is that, courtrooms may look a little different. At least in the short term. I think, you know, this sort of discovery by Blitzkrieg where you just take, 100 depositions so you can sort of wear down the other side may go by the wayside, just because practically it's tough to get people with travel and things like that. That's what I think is going to happen. What I hope is going to happen is that it refocuses people on the fact that, litigation is not the end all be all. That there are better ways potentially to resolve disputes, and the court should really be, sort of the venue of last choice if there's a conflict.
Yeah, I would like to say, are you finding as well that I'm finding that this pandemic is leading to a lot of resolved cases, except for people who are powerful or are coming from positions of power, that they're still trying to ram everything through with another lawsuit, another lawsuit, another lawsuit.
I think that's right, but I also think that it works for the other end of the spectrum, and I hope it does. And that is that the courts need to be there and functioning and ready to go for folks like the family of this poor guy who just passed away. Who was murdered by police officers, and we need to make sure that the courts are ready to go for that.
Yeah, I found, and I know there's probably a judge somewhere who's watching this, I found that the courts have badly screwed the pooch on this thing. They've been unprepared, and many of the judges, God bless them, good people, have no idea as to how bad things were at the courts. I had one said, oh, well, check the court website. Like, I checked the court website. It doesn't tell me anything about where my client is. It doesn't tell me why my cases have been moved, but no one told me. A DA who found out what was a case had been moved an hour before they called me, which is an hour before we were both supposed to be in court. Just bad. I'm hoping that one of the things we'll get from this is, for one, I'd love to see a system like we have with the federal courts, where everything is like electronic, all the filings are electronic, and No, the onus isn't on us to always check the website. You send out electronic notices, because what's the point of us giving you our emails if you're not going to use them?
Totally agree. The State Bar of California just went through an exercise, I think, last year on their access to justice programs and making sure that we are making the judicial system accessible to everyone and making it easy to use, because it's our institution. It's not for folks who can afford it. It's for everyone. And I think there's some good recommendations that came out of this State Bar Committee on that.
Yeah, I want to bring you back to talk about that, because that's a major issue, I think, for both us in industry, for the public. And you know, I always fall in the category of, if there's a problem that's going on with the courts, you know, you guys can always lower your prices. That will always, you know, change the cost of litigation.
Agreed.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We went on this without a net. I'm glad we were able to do it. It has been absolutely great. Let's see, your daughter, she's home from Ole Miss right now, right?
She's home from Ole Miss. We just got back. I actually went back there last weekend to move her out of her dorm finally, but she's back home, and she'll go back in August.
Good. What's it like being 50 and a parent now?
Well, for the record, I'm 49. I won't be 50 until November, so I'm going to milk that for all it's worth. But I feel old, Eric.
Well, you know, my Uncle Otis always used to say, God bless him, and I'll end it with this. He always used to say, I don't mind getting old because it means I didn't die young.
Amen. Amen.
All right. Thank you so much, Alex.
You got it,
Alexander Hamilton Sharon. Go check out the stuff that he's – I don't know if the OC Weekly archives are there, but there are plenty of things you can find. And, Alex, we hope you're going to be writing some more, hopefully a book, so we can go ahead and buy, take a look at it.
I will. And I appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity, man.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
All right,
everybody. Well, we want to thank you again for joining us here on Wrestling. Actually, this is the first time you've had the chance to join us, because it's the first live broadcast. We have other broadcasts that are going to be coming up soon. We just need to finish the editing. Joey Munoz, actor Patrick Cronin, Richard Garrison, the former head of the Pace Department, and, of course, the legendary Les Thatcher. So with that, thank you very much. And remember, whatever it is we're wrestling with, let's go ahead and wrestle with it together. Right? Thank you.